This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
The second lowest form of communication is talking about executing computer things on the radio.
That's how
and
we
if
do
you
it
like that, quality. Then you should listen to Tech Talks, a show weekly on WRFL, where some of our favorite WRFL personalities do, in fact, talk about all kinds of computer stuff all the time.
Yes.
And this sounds like a slam, but actually I kind of love those guys.
Tune in Thursdays 6 to 8.
That is right, everyone. Thursday, 6 to 8, this show right here. Sort of creepy sounding, but I guarantee what we talk about is nowhere near as dark as what that promo made it sound like. Isn't that right, my wonderful co-host?
Yeah, we are in a dungeon, though. That part's right. I feel like for 2 hours we convert this place into the world's smallest mad scientist lab.
With only a radio board and a bunch of CDs as its only equipment?
Yes.
It's not much for a lab.
We're that good. It's about the mind, not the equipment.
I don't think we're really that good. I think you're making that up.
I think we are.
Well, in that case, let's continue on to our first article, which you have summoned up for us from the depths of this particular tech dungeon, as you so put it.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually a story that I ran into first this morning. And lo and behold, my gut on this is right. A little bit of fact sharing coming to you. You might have seen an article shared on Facebook this morning predicting that there are several days of complete darkness that will be coming in November per a NASA prediction. Firstly, NASA is not predicting that, and secondly, it won't happen because what they describe in the article is really just kind of an elaborate joke. I guess is probably the best way to say it. So there were articles published this week that said that there was going to be a hoax in which... I don't even know how to explain it. There was an alignment where Venus was going to act as a magnifying glass and cause an incredible point of heat on Jupiter, and then that was going to blow out into outer space, and then when some of Jupiter's dust came to hit the sun, it would cause the sun to darken. And none of that is true because it's all wildly infeasible. As far as that goes, Jupiter is something like a couple hundred million miles away from... almost 500 million miles away from the sun, which for dust to travel that kind of distance just doesn't work out. And so if you woke up to that fearful headline, have no worry, there is no 1,000-page report about it, and NASA's verified that this is not something that's happening. It's just something that seems to have cropped up in the wake of the eclipse, which we'll talk about here in a bit. But switching topics for a second, Mitch, I have one that you might be interested in.
Oh, do tell.
The American National Geologic Survey and NASA are going to be working together at Yellowstone to find and identify places to add geysers. They're going to engineer extra geysers into Yellowstone as a way of wicking away heat in an attempt to prevent the supervolcano, which I think we've talked about before, but that's part of what makes Yellowstone so interesting as a feature, is that there's a tremendous amount of energy pent up there under the surface, and it causes all of these water pools to heat up, and that's what creates a lot of the geysers and a lot of the interesting geological features there. Well, the National Geologic Survey wants to engineer a handful more of geysers that they can add in to help wick that heat away, because the more you can wick the heat away, of course, the slower the magma underneath is going to be moving, and the less likely for an eruption that we'll be set up with.
Okay. So that is kind of neat. I would say that definitely falls under the category of terraforming.
I was going to say the exact thing. Yeah. This is probably the largest scale, as far as an intentional engineered terraforming, that we've ever participated in on Earth as a distinct thing, and that it would be covering lava flows that can run for hundreds of miles and be as wide across as a mile or two. And so it's, man, it's super cool that that's actually something that they want to go after. And so as far as that goes, NASA calculated that it would take something like 30 to 35% cooling on a supervolcano that was about to erupt to keep it from doing so. And so, but they can't drill, of course. They have to get more creative than that, because drilling could cause the exact kind of event they're trying to
prevent, and basically create an outlet for that lava flow. And then, what's the name of that movie where they so amazingly captured how devastating that would be? Is it called, just called Yellowstone, I think?
I don't think I've seen that one.
I've seen parts of it, namely, it's a movie that basically predicts what would happen if Yellowstone actually erupted. And one of the part, there are two scenes I remember distinctly from this movie. The first one being a bunch of people in an SUV trying to outrun a pyroclastic flow, which is not possible. It's kind of not.
Yeah.
Not with the speeds that a SUV can go at.
Yeah. That's what's funny. So it actually largely seems to depend on the temperature, because there's some spots in the world where magma flows, lava flows on the surface, are incredibly painfully slow.
Well, it's not magma. It's nothing to do with magma. The pyroclastic flow is whenever the volcano first erupts and you get that huge billowing mm-hmm. cloud of superheated dust and rock. Eventually, the pressure underneath that, forcing all of that up into the sky, dissipates to a certain point. And then so, because that stuff is so dense, now that that pressure is no longer underneath it, it begins to fall and collapse back down and then spread out. And it's basically you're having a superheated wave of
ash, rock,
and dust.
Yeah.
You're basically having a plasma wave. I mean, it's superheated to the point where it's not glowing, but like plasma, you would expect plasma to do, but it basically is going to do to you the same thing that plasma would do. It's going to vaporize you instantly.
It's like a 1,000-degree sandstorm.
Yeah, exactly. It's a 1,000-degree Celsius sandstorm.
Yeah.
Which is nothing to mess around with.
Painful.
Anyways, the second scene of this movie I remember is after the eruption, after we talk about that lovely little bit of fun info. There's this old, like, I want to say it's old in the movie, but it's a drive-in motel type deal. You know, one story, not a whole lot. And the ash is just coming down, and you see people running through the ash and then suddenly seizing up because they've, you know, when you breathe in ash from a volcanic eruption, what it does is it basically forms cement in the bottom of your lungs. It mixes with the water in your lungs and then sets up and dries into a cement, effectively cutting off your ability to breathe. So there were just a bunch of people who suddenly were not able to breathe because they had inhaled too much ash and didn't know what it was. They thought it was snow. So, those, I can't remember the name of that movie, but I wish I could. Those are the two most memorable scenes of having seen it as like a 9-year-old or something like that. Anywho. So with that wonderful topic of conversation out of the way, it's going to be interesting to see how they manage to actually naturally induce these geysers to cool the magma flows underneath the crust there in Yellowstone and not damage the ecology.
Yeah.
For example, the ecology in Yellowstone is so delicate. I think they introduced, about 10 years ago, 20 wolves, like timber wolves or something like that, and yeah. it actually really restabilized the economy or the ecology of the area because a bunch of the deer were eating the budding trees and grass mm-hmm. that were growing up near streams. And so they stopped seeing these streams walking all over the place as they do with soil erosion, things like that from year to year. And then the banks of the you know streams and whatnot started solidifying because of trees being able to take root. And basically they really overturned soil erosion. And as a result, a specific type of plant native to another type of like, I want to say like field mouse came back. And then the field mice came back to the area. So it's a very incredibly minute what happens whenever you mess with an ecology like Yellowstone or really any ecosystem.
Yeah. And that was about a year or two ago. And so I think what was so interesting is that it reintroducing wolves had an impact on soil erosion, which is a good couple steps apart, but it really shows how deeply interconnected the ecology of a region can be. And I think it really proves how careful you have to be with a region that you're trying to protect and encourage growth in, like Yellowstone. But on a related note, it's the same reason or a similar human intervention is the same reason why we've had more frequently occurring bad forest fires, including in this part of the U.S. And it's because when fire is dispatched to take out small forest fires, and they're able to, then the undergrowth doesn't get the full amount of burn it should have. Mm-hmm. And so then when a fire does manage to break that threshold, there's so much undergrowth that it burns it all. It burns hotter and faster than what it should and what it naturally would if we weren't around to try to put the fires out. And so an attempt to put out the fire really only makes the next fire stronger. And that's the impact that we've had over the past couple of centuries in this region. To such a degree that the ground growth is far beyond what's normal. And so that's part of why we've encountered a lot of really strong forest fires recently that have been fairly memorable over mm-hmm. the past.
Like in Gatlinburg in Tennessee, because mm-hmm. where those had been residential areas, not a whole lot of the undergrowth had been able to burn off. And then that burn started and it just went out of control because there was so much fuel there.
Exactly, yeah. But that's something that, again, it's a couple steps removed the cause from the effect, and it has that kind of an impact on it. But thanks for chatting. That was good.
That was. So with that, we're going to get back to the music. We're going to keep going on this funky vein for
what
a little bit.
What do you got coming up next?
Up next, we have Hearts with their album Smoke, Fire, Hope, and Desire. It's described as electro-funk, so we're going to see how that goes. And we're going to be hearing the song Fire. So with that, keep it locked here at your only alternative left, WRFL, Lexington.
If you're hearing this, that means podcast advertising works. WRFL is now accepting new applications for advertising in a selection of our original podcast series. If you or someone you know owns a business in Central Kentucky and would be interested in advertising on WRFL's original podcasts, please email development@wrfl.fm.
All right, everyone. Thank you for tuning in and checking out with us this wonderful Thursday of the brand spanking new WRFL show schedule. That is right. For nearly the third year in a row, we are operating out of the Thursday 6 to 8 p.m. slot. We've been very happy with the slot. We hope you all have been too. And if you haven't, well, I'm sorry. That's really all I can offer you at this moment.
That's really strange to me, actually, that here
we are.
It's
been 3 years almost.
Nearly. At
January.
The end of this semester.
In January, it will have been 3 years on this show. That's not many RFL shows last a full 3 years.
How do we put up with each other?
I think the foam baseball bats and therapy sessions are what really, really helps.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah. Not.
Urawea lipolitasia. I butchered it, but I gave it my best shot.
Oh, I thought you were just saying you would like to see me, but okay. Anyways,
that
what is it?
Is the name of a very flexible and formidable kind of yeast. And yes, I'm talking about the kind of yeast that you put in your bread and the kind of yeast that makes alcohol. It's not
specifically... This isn't the kind of yeast that you would want to make bread out of or alcohol out of. It's of the same type. I mean, yeast is what we're describing here.
Yeah.
But this is a type of yeast that does not do those things.
So it's of the same family as the common bread rising and of the common beer-making kinds of microbes. But this particular variety of yeast has some interesting things out of liquids, including waste, and use it to produce long chains of monomers, or polymers, or plastics.
Or other kinds of mers, like, you know, the Dunmer or the merfolk, you know, things like that.
So this bacteria, this yeast, this microbe, this yeast, is able to grow in nitrogen-rich environments, which includes human waste, and it's able to produce carbon, work for us out in the wild, rechaining our waste into usable 3D printable material. We're talking about the kind of polymer that you can use, the kind of polyester that you can use in a 3D printer.
You know, this is going to be really great for like one of those generation ships that we're eventually going to send out to travel between stars, because they can only fit so much oil on there, and oil is kind of key in making plastics. So with this kind of thing, you wouldn't have to really worry about that, because there's always one thing you can count on people doing.
Exactly. So that's the idea. We could take a little bit of this yeast with us to Mars or to anywhere else where it would be hard to get your hands on raw material, and use it as a bioplastic. And so the idea of a bioplastic's been around for a long time.
So you're telling me Mark Watney, if he had this yeast, could have taken some of it and patched in that little blowout that killed his potato farm.
Exactly. That's the kind of strong, flexible materials we're talking about here.
Wonderful. It's like, what, a week and a half? And then he was like, oh, looks like I'm going to be here for 3 years. Thanks, guys.
But, yeah, it's exactly that kind of long-term waste-conscious and resource-conscious thinking that's going to bring us forward, because we can't expect a space colony like something that could, in theory, be permanently established on Mars. I mean, we have every other piece of the technology, more or less, at this point, but we don't have a good, sustainable way to get materials there long-term. And even missing a single shipment on a place like that, not only is shipping goods to them incredibly expensive, but it's risky. If you miss a deadline, now...
It could really end up being a deadline.
Exactly. So... with that in mind, this is the goal of this lipolitasia that we've been talking about. And so I just wanted to share that with you. And it's not limited just to space use. There's a lot of use even
so
here
I'm
on
curious,
Earth for bioplastics.
Is this bioplastic biodegradable?
Somewhat. More than the oil-based ones,
yeah.
I should say. It's not entirely biodegradable, but it is somewhat in the sense. Have you ever seen a cornstarch plastic cup?
Yes, actually. I've seen there's actually a company now starting to sell water where they come in, basically, it's like a giant water droplet in your hand, and then you just sort of bite into it and then drink the water, and then the actual coating that it was in, you can actually eat so that there's absolutely nothing left over.
So, with the same idea as those plastic cornstarch cups, these are equally recyclable. You know, they're definitely... And so I think there's some promise there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I mean, it goes even beyond just like human waste. I mean, there's a lot of waste on farms and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea that you could.
But the other thing, too, we have to be careful with is that some of that, for example, farm waste is often used as fertilizer.
Certainly.
And so if you are suddenly taking a good portion of that away to use for the plastics industry, your fertilizer industry may in fact be hurt, which could lead to food shortages, and then you won't need the plastics. Not to mention, well, you know, I understand we're attempting to get away from petroleum just as a general rule, but there are certain aspects that I think it would be better to be making like plastics out of petroleum so that we have something that's used for. Because if you think about it, we're getting to where we're wanting to stay, you know, get away from using petroleum as a fuel source. Got it. Okay. So, you know, a seismic event that causes more or less a burst of oil up above. And you have these massive oil spills as opposed to, you know, that you have a drilling platform that's going to be safely extracting all of that oil. So I don't know. I'm just playing devil's advocate for it. There's a couple things that come to mind.
Yeah, yeah. And where I see the point that you're making, I'm not sure that I can agree with the phrase safe oil extraction via offshore pump.
To an extent. I mean, it's one of... I would say it's... if imagine today we stopped using oil for fuel and plastics. What other use for petroleum is there at this moment?
So I also think that the cold turkey analysis isn't terribly fair either. We're not going to just stop using oil one day. We're going to wean off of it over the next couple of decades if we do. And so I don't think we have to worry about upending a market by weaning our way out of it. But you know, I think we'll get there. I think it'll be much. I think the weaning will be much more gentle. Than you expect.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably going to end up being like coal, which, you know, it sucks. As I've said many times, my family is dependent on coal. And so to see an industry that affects the bottom line of my family being phased out is particularly hard, as I'm sure it is with many folks in West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky. There are some of the flat, you know, coal fields, if you will. And so, you know, it's a big industry that's on its way out. And one of the key things that coal is still used for is production of steel. And I hate to say it, you don't see America slowing down on their steel consumption anytime soon. So there's always going to have to be a certain amount of coal being extracted and used to make steel.
Yeah, yeah.
The question is, are other countries just going to deal with it and us buy? You know, are we going to become a consumer society of steel, for example? Or is there eventually going to be some sort of resurgence where we start making a good portion of American-made steel again, and will that cause a demand for coal again?
So,
I doubt that will happen, because a lot of people don't think of this. Whenever you close down a steel mill, the chambers with which you use to heat the steel... those giant furnaces have these ceramic interiors, if you will, a bunch of ceramic tiles that are super heat reflective. It's basically opposite of a heat shield, like whenever you look at a spacecraft
the
on
black
reentry.
Nose cone.
Yeah, that's all ceramic plates. And so once you cool down one of those furnaces that are used to make steel, all of those ceramic, or at least a good portion of those ceramic tiles, break. So it's not like you can just come back in and fire up the furnace and start making steel again. There's got to be a significant investment in getting a steel mill back up and running after it's shut down. Coal, but we'll never know.
Yeah. And certainly, before we leave the topic, it is something that I think this region needs. A lot of it is very aware of. It needs to be very aware of. And so the challenge comes, as you said, in transitioning out. And, you know, it's taken...
The problem, though, about transitioning out, though, and not to interrupt you again, but a lot of people, there's this misconception about, well, why don't they just go, if they're already in the power industry, why don't we just transition them to learn or to basically install solar panels or wind turbines or turbines in order to... generate electricity. And the problem is that most of the folks that go into the coal industry maybe have a high school education. I would say about 70% of them probably finished high school. I would say there's a good solid 30% of coal miners who probably never got a traditional high school degree. They may have gotten a GED or just absolutely dropped out and did not finish their high school education. The problem with that is that installing solar panels and doing wiring work and installing wind turbines is an extremely technical job. Even though we're basically half electrical engineers, to go out and just figure out how to install a solar panel. One of the large commercial use solar panels. Miners haven't had and probably won't have, but especially if people our age coming straight out of high school aren't able to get financial support to go to college. How are these coal miners that have been forced out of their jobs going to pay for school? It's just a no-win situation unless we start incentivizing re-education programs and start funding re-education programs to where someone who was a coal miner or in an industry reliant on coal can go for free and get re-educated and then... be able to be hireable to a job industry in the area. The other thing too is that all those areas in the West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Southeastern Ohio, there's not a whole lot of industry there. All the industry that is there has been built up around the coal industry. Services for families of coal miners, things like that, and all of those are going to get impacted too. So once coal finally goes away, unless we invest in those areas, it's going to be an economic collapse inside of Appalachia and any other coal dependent communities across the nation. But I don't know. We digressed again, and it's another one of those situations where we've got some time to do it, but at this point, we're going to see the end of coal before we ever see the end of petroleum.
Oh yes, by a good couple miles there. And you're right. As far as it goes, we have to look at retooling from any and every angle we can. It's not just retraining for high-tech jobs. We need to find any way that we can get a labor force as coal continues to slip. It's been a long road, unfortunately a long time coming. This process has been sliding for decades at this point. Something like 60 years or so of continuous droppings. So it's going to be a challenge. I don't think we have all of the answers right now, but it's something we definitely need to be putting more resources into. So
agreed. Well, we kind of got off in the weeds there. Sorry about that. What else do we have?
All right. Let's talk about an event that happened on Monday. So
an event? Is this event a thing that may or may not have involved the sun and or the moon?
Also the moon? Yes.
Well, based on the trajectory of the sun and moon, I would say it's at the bottom of the ocean. I bit lots of holes in it. What video is that from, good sir?
I completely missed you there. I switched headphones.
Well, I'm not going to repeat myself. The listeners would get mad at me. Anyways, yes, a thing with the sun and the moon did happen on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't Monday short for like the quote unquote moon day?
Yeah.
Like, isn't that the origin of the name Monday?
Sun's day, moon.
What exactly a fun right. Little tautology right there.
Yeah. And so, as far as Monday went, it's the shadow of the sun. And that is a reasonably rare event. What happens is the moon, like the Earth's orbit, isn't perfectly circular. It's a little bit elongated. It's a little bit like an oval. So sometimes when you have an eclipse, the moon is closer, and sometimes when you have an eclipse, the moon's a little bit farther away from the Earth. And that little bit of deviation, that couple of percent difference between the closer end of the arc and the farther end of the arc, is enough to change whether the entire sun is obscured or not. And so when it's completely obscured, we call it a total solar eclipse. And the closer it is to the perfect apogee, the more people in the space. And we had a fairly large band of 70 miles. But mm-hmm. here in 7 years, in 2023, we're going to see a partial solar eclipse. There will be no point on Earth that has the total
coverage, yeah.
The pitch blackness that you saw a little bit west and south of here on that arc. And so everything will look at best about like it did in Lexington.
Yeah, which if you didn't notice here in Lexington, what it ended up looking like, it looked kind of like if a large thunderstorm is coming up throughout in the middle of the day, mm-hmm. it gets very dark, it thunderstorms, it almost looks nighttime, and then suddenly the storm is gone, and all of a sudden it's twilight. So
you got down to right around a crescent where I was on Monday. We actually very very close to Hopkinsville got all the way down to the point that the streetlights came on and stayed on for about 3 or 4 minutes, and the full coverage came to be, and it was a very strange experience going from 99. To, you know, like 99.9% mm-hmm. a percent, because it went from being twilight to being like full off dark, and it was where there was this very gradual change over the period of an hour when you were outside. There's a very rapid change that happens in the last minute prior to an eclipse, and it was very very strange. And there's actually some really cool photos from the International Space Station of watching on my head. But the year after that, there's going to be another total eclipse in 2024. Mm-hmm. And the arc is going to be moving up out of Mexico and Texas and up across to Maine. So Kentucky is going to be one of three states that is in the perfect axis of both.
Mm-hmm.
There's an area kind of close to St. Louis
mm-hmm.
that's about 70 miles by 50 miles that's going to be the junction of where both
yesterday's
eclipse
and
and the one happening in 2024. So that's pretty cool.
So, you know, and there were a bunch of people saying that we haven't had a total solar eclipse since like the, you know, 70s. Did calculations on the position of the sun and moon and Earth relative all to each other for up to 2012, and their civilization collapsed
around the 12 or 1400.
Right as we were kind of coming out of the dark, and then what grew out of that were the Incans. I believe they grew out of that. I could be totally wrong. And that the Incans were the prevalent peak society at the time when Hernan Cortes came in from Spain and began the conquest of the Incas. So, you know, they were able to plot out with a surprising amount of precision the position of the Earth, monsoon, blah, 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 Earth, Moon, and Sun relative to each other. And so part of that is like what we're experiencing now. There will be cycles where there are many total solar eclipses in a particular area. And that just happens to do with where the sun is, or where the moon is on its particular trip around the Earth, and the Earth's particular trip around the sun. And then it could easily be another 100 years after that 2020 in proximity. You know, the total solar eclipse, then in 2023, you said, was the partial solar eclipse. Mm-hmm. And then in 2024, another total solar eclipse.
That's right.
All in the span of about 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly enough, there are two happening in South America in 2019 and 2020, going through Chile and Argentina in the South Pacific. And then there's actually going to be one in Antarctica in 2021. Antarctica.
Fun story about Antarctica. So I was reading an article the other day. They found a perfectly preserved fruitcake from like the late 1700s down there at one of the very first. So if you haven't ever, you know, paid any much attention to the Antarctic expeditions of the early 18th century, I believe it's 18th or late 18th, early 19th century. There were a couple predestined places you would go. You would land at a certain spot and there would be a shack there. And that was built by more or less the first expedition. And then you would go out a little further and there was another shack that I think ended up being built by the second expedition to Antarctica. And so, you know, for a long period of time, if you were traveling to Antarctica, you stayed at those places. They were sort of, hotels, if you will, the true Antarctic hotel. And so they were rediscovering one of the early shelters that had been lost, and portions of it had been filled in, and they are excavating it. And they found in a, you know, corroded metal tin, a perfectly preserved fruit cake in its original wax paper wrapping. And the wax paper
sleeve?
Yes, and the wax paper was still, you know, it was still sealed enough, and the, you know, you could have cut it out and taken a bite of it, and it would have been perfectly, it would have been the exact same as if it had been, you cut a piece of it in like 1790.
Huh.
Something like that. Wow. So with that, they have decided they're going to begin preserving it and then displaying it. I think there's a replica in Australia of the site that they are putting in a museum, and they're putting it on display there. And it's being treated with chemicals, so it won't be edible anymore after they're done treating it. But for something like that to have lasted in Antarctica truly speaks to the inhospitable terrain that that place is. The fact that there are no bacteria cells that were able to make it into that fruitcake and proliferate and more or less mold that fruitcake just is kind of amazing.
Yeah, actually, that's astonishing that anything could survive for that amount of time.
And I'm kind of surprised, I don't know if we do, but I'm kind of surprised more space programs don't do. Yeah, you would think that they would more astronauts would train there as a result of the truly inhumane condition. I mean, the only thing that the Antarctica has that, say, the moon doesn't is maybe oxygen and the ability to melt snow into water. It's probably the two main things, which you could easily control in a training environment.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Well, with that, do you have another article, or do we want to go on? And
one more
for the road, everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Sticking with the eclipse a little bit. They collected some very interesting data, and I will link to it when I can find a link to the original article. But an astronomer got data from 68 different telescopes that were all positioned along the trip and got a 90-minute long video of complete eclipse because the pacing of them, the spacing, was just far away enough that when one was starting to leave totality, the next telescope camera would pick it up. Just light and a little bit of atmosphere. And so in here on Earth, because they got an unprecedented
amount of data there
on the corona, where you can actually see and make out the details of it for 90
straight
minutes.
And I almost wonder how many cameras were damaged by this solar eclipse. They said don't look at it directly with your eyes, but surely looking at it with say a smartphone camera has had to have had some impact on the operational value of that smartphone camera.
You're right. And so in the same way that your eyes, the nerves in your eyes, can be overwhelmed and damaged by the extremely intense brightness of the sun, you know, the mid and high level radiation that comes out of the sun. Some gets caught by the atmosphere, but when you stare at the sun under normal conditions, your eyes will tend to avert and shut because it's so bright. But the eclipse doesn't do that, which is why the concerns about eye damage. But the same thing happens to electronic equipment. It becomes overwhelmed by the brightness of the sun relative to everything that it's used to normally measuring. And so it kind of clips out, so to speak, from a brightness perspective, and it can damage the equipment. And it does measurably damage equipment.
Hmm. Alrighty. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in, and we will see you all next week. Enjoy the new schedule here on WRFL, and...
They're going to be doing radio, but we're not going to be doing radio. We're going to be headed out.
So. Yeah, we're done doing our radio, and now they're going to do their radio. And this is collectively our radio, right?
All
right. Is that how this works?
Time to do some radio.
Is it? Is it really? Didn't we just do radio? Have we done did the radio that has needed to be done?
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.